more action needs to be taken on the Myanmar side in terms of freedom of movement, access to services, ending the discrimination.
A renewed focus on Rohingyas. It's Thursday, May 20th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. You can find us at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, a new Chinese university, reestablishing supply chains, a concrete solution, fewer babies, cemetery art. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The United States says it is providing new assistance to Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim minority, many of whom have fled violence for neighboring Bangladesh or have been internally displaced. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a press release that $155 million in additional funds will be used to sustain critical efforts to support Rohingya refugees and host communities in Bangladesh and internally displaced Rohingya and other affected people in Burma. Meanwhile, at the launch of this year's Rohingya Refugee Donors Conference, Bangladesh led a chorus of growing voices calling for durable solutions to resolve the ongoing crisis. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
New pledges have been rolling in, but UN agencies are expressing concern about donor fatigue. They worry they might not receive the $943 million they need to assist 1.4 million Rohingya refugees and the Bangladeshi communities hosting them in Cox's Bazar. Last year, the UN's $1 billion joint response plan garnered only 60% of that amount. Bangladesh State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Shahryar Alam, says the launch is the fourth annual appeal for the Rohingya temporarily sheltering in his country. He says he wondered how long the refugees can continue to suffer in overcrowded camps and how long the international community can sustain such massive humanitarian support. He says it is important to seek a permanent solution to the Rohingya refugee crisis to avoid repeating similar exercises every year.
All undertakings under the GRP or any other funding mechanism should be implemented, keeping this overarching objective in mind. The priority areas that have been identified in the GRP must be aligned with the core objective of preparing the Rohingyas for their return. And any projects such as education or skill development should be designed and implemented in ways that will help Rohingyas to integrate in their society upon their return to Myanmar.
The minister acknowledges this might not be the most propitious time for the Rohingya to return home. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, agrees the military coup by Myanmar's generals on February 1st precludes the safe and dignified return of the refugees. He says the UNHCR and other agencies are present in Rakhine State in Myanmar to create the conditions necessary for the refugees to return to their homes of origin.
Clearly, this has not happened so far because besides the work that we do, more action needs to be taken on the Myanmar side in terms of freedom of movement, access to services, ending the discrimination that has caused, in fact, the exodus of people into Bangladesh.
Meanwhile, High Commissioner Grandi says the Rohingya people must not be forgotten. He says the international community must continue to support the refugees as they have no other means of survival. He notes Rohingya continue to flee violence in Myanmar. He renews his appeal to neighboring countries, mainly India and Thailand, to keep their borders open and not to deport them back to a country where their lives are at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. India posts record-setting one-day COVID-19 death toll. Indian Navy ships recover 22 bodies of people who died on sinking barge. U.S. announces increase in aid to Rohingya. South Korean president to meet Biden at White House. Taiwan, once an icon for COVID control, grapples now with first serious outbreak. You'll find much more on these stories with expanded coverage at Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and of course our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Hungary has announced plans to open a branch of a Chinese university in Budapest. Critics fear the development of the first of its kind in Europe will be used by Beijing to spread Chinese Communist Party propaganda. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Budapest, soon to become the first European host of a Chinese university. Under the plans, this wasteland outside the city will soon become a branch of the Shanghai-based Fudan University. Hungary says it will raise education standards, offer courses to 6,000 students, and bring Chinese investment and research to the country. For China, it's a significant milestone, says analyst Steve Sang.
Now they are exporting a Chinese university branch on European soil, a member of the European unit. This is, I think, tremendously important from their perspective in how it shows that China has risen.
2 years ago, Hungary's Central European University, backed by Hungarian-born US-based financier George Soros, was effectively forced out of the country through changes to the education law. Hungary's government accuses Soros of political interference, which he denies. The mayor of Budapest, a member of the political opposition, says Hungarians are being betrayed.
Let's put the two next to each other. There was something which has offered an open education, did not cost a penny for Hungarian taxpayers, was a well-established university in Hungary, and was exiled. And now the government brings in another one which represents the ideology of the Communist Party and costs the Hungarian taxpayers billions.
Leaked government documents estimate the cost at $1.8 billion, more than Hungary spent on its entire higher education system in 2019. Most of the funding will come from a Chinese bank loan, and construction will be carried out using mostly Chinese materials and labor. Fudan ranks among the top 100 universities in the world. Its expansion into Europe is part of Beijing's efforts to control the narrative on China, according to Tsang.
When we are dealing with the humanities and social sciences side of the curriculum, it is clear that the Communist Party will keep control of it. It was only in the last 2 years that the Fudan University changed clearly its instructions on its relationship with the party state, now clearly declaring that its first mission is not to uphold academic integrity, but to follow the leadership of the party.
In a statement to VOA, the Hungarian government said that Fudan is one of the best universities in the world that will not be engaged in ideological education, but will provide economic courses. The U.S. Embassy in Budapest has released a statement expressing its concerns, given, in its words, Beijing's proven track record of using academic institutions to advance a malign influence agenda and stifle intellectual freedom. The university campus is expected to be built by 2024. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Happening now in Asia, China's foreign ministry said the United States' anti-Beijing Winter Olympics remarks were, quote, full of lies. A day after U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for a U.S. diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Games. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. In February, the Biden administration ordered a review of critical U.S. supply chains after COVID lockdowns disrupted many vital production networks. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more on those disruptions, which led to creative problem-solving for organizations delivering life-saving aid.
And Ayesin Dieng walks in the footsteps of her foremothers. Like generations of Senegalese women before her, Dieng dries, smokes, and salts fermented fish caught by the men in her community. But then the pandemic came. Many men stopped fishing. When women found fish, they did not have buyers. Markets closed, borders followed, the supply chain snapped.
COVID has changed our work and our life. Since there is COVID, we live in fear. We are afraid to go far and be affected by COVID-19. It has caused a very, very, very big impact on our local community.
Dieng's story is one of supply chains. While her local economy suffers, so too do the economies up and down the chain. The markets, the mariners, all of the people who make their livings through commerce and trade. The issue also hits home with those working in global health. Gashao Shifarao is senior technical advisor at the nonprofit Management Sciences for Health, or MSH. The organization works with governments in more than 40 mostly low-income countries to provide supply chain solutions to their health programs. Success, he says, is all about getting the right medicines to the right places.
You need products to be successful, to have a successful health program implementation. So to get those products, you need to have a system, and that system is a supply chain.
These chains are only as strong as their weakest link, and this past year put weak links to the test.
COVID is a great lesson, which is a disaster. I mean, we looked at last year when there is global shortage everywhere, including the United States. That was a panic where the regular supply chain system we have been working we need to rethink.
Shifarao says MSH worked with the government of the Philippines to develop a data collection app that shows the number of resources and areas in need to keep the supply chains moving. He credits years of work on supply chain infrastructure.
For the last 10 to 15 years, they brought supply chain as part of the whole comprehensive strategy. So they start to give attention. Government starts giving attention to the supply chain.
And while he praises governments for embracing supply chains, he says more buy-in from the private sector and a stronger sales pitch from governments is needed. Shifarao says it's essential to consider all of the elements that go into even a single dose of medicine.
They need a warehouse. You need syringes. You need vials. And you need to have a waste management system. And you need to have even a reverse logistics. It's mind-boggling.
Ultimately, Shifarao says he's optimistic that global health supply chains are bouncing forward, not back, after the year of the pandemic. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. International Olympic Committee Chief Thomas Bach said most athletes and team members staying at Tokyo's Olympic Village will be vaccinated by the start of the Games as organizers try to calm fears about staging the event as coronavirus cases surge in Japan. You'll find this and more on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. China is the largest global consumer of concrete, but the United States is planning to use much more, as President Joe Biden is proposing a $2.3 trillion infrastructure build-out as a way to boost the economy, create jobs, and fight climate change. But the concrete used to build roads, bridges, and other infrastructure is one of the biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide. VOA's Steve Barragona has a look at efforts to lighten concrete's heavy climate impact.
These are no ordinary concrete blocks. They're made by a company called CarbonBuilt with a special recipe and baked in a special oven. Gaurav Sant is CarbonBuilt's founder.
What makes them different from the convection oven that you have at home is that we put in carbon dioxide in the form of flue gas. Think about the emissions from the smokestack of a power plant. That's what we put into our convection oven. And they come out at the end infused with carbon dioxide.
That carbon dioxide is locked away forever inside those blocks. That's important because making concrete generates a lot of CO2. Concrete is a mix of stone and sand held together with cement. Making cement involves burning limestone at 1,500 degrees Celsius. The flame creates CO2, but the hot limestone itself releases even more. Every ton of concrete generates a ton of CO2, and demand for it is soaring with the growing population, says University of Michigan Global CO2 Initiative Director Volker Sick.
If we then do not find ways to make concrete in a more benign way, we do have a problem.
One more benign way? CarbonBuilt is one of several companies that have modified their recipes so that the cement takes up carbon dioxide. That does more than just keep the CO2 out of the atmosphere, says CarbonCure President Jennifer Wagner.
That the CO2 also acts as a strengthener of the concrete. So by adding the CO2, they can achieve the desired strength with less cement.
Less cement means less CO2, but also saves money. That can help win customers, Wagner says.
Everybody wants to build green, but they don't necessarily want to pay more.
The process can cut carbon emissions in half in some cases. CarbonBuilt and CarbonCure recently won the Carbon X Prize for turning CO2 emissions into market-ready products. It's a good start, says Volker Sick.
I think it showcases the potential. Is it ready to be implemented everywhere now? We have ways to go.
Right now, we have about 300 concrete plants around the world who are using the technology every day. There are about 100,000 plants out there. So we really are just scratching the surface.
The technology is starting to make inroads. Another company, Solidia, is selling concrete pavers that use a similar process. But concrete is the most abundant human-made material on Earth, so there's a long way to go to lighten its heavy climate impact. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, a hate crimes bill to combat violence against Asian Americans in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic passed the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly. It now heads to President Joe Biden for signing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, China, Japan, South Korea, and many other areas in Asia are dealing with falling birth rates and a shrinking population. New data shows the birth rate in the United States has also dropped significantly for every major race and age group during the past year. Experts not only blame uncertainty over coronavirus for part of that decline, but also say the U.S. COVID baby bust reflects long-running trends in other developed nations. VOA's Laurel Bowman has the story.
New data show that last year, the U.S. birth rate dropped by its largest single-year decrease in nearly 50 years. The 4% rate drop came from declines in births for every major race and ethnicity and in nearly every age group. Even women in their late 30s and 40s, which in past years had seen rates go up.
But between 2019 and 2020, we saw a 4% decline in both the number of births and the general fertility rate, which is a little on the extraordinary side.
Experts say the COVID-19 pandemic surely contributed to last year's big decline, but they also blame economic anxiety. Many Americans' health insurance depends on their employer.
Children are very expensive, and certainly job security, it would be a factor in that. And I think that's one of the compounding factors with the pandemic is sort of the underlying uncertainty about job security.
Deidre Miller is an OBGYN and fertility nurse and a mother herself. She says cost is big on the minds of parents wanting children, especially during COVID.
One of the main questions that we hear from patients is, what am I going to be billed after delivery or even during, you know, their ultrasounds and things? How much is this going to cost? I actually had my daughter last year in March, so she is 14 months old now. Of course, the cost was a huge factor. I might have gotten better care if I had been at a larger hospital. That was a concern of mine. Am I going to get this large, you know, $36,000 bill, $30,000 bill for being a patient there?
While unpredictable billing in the U.S. healthcare system is a factor in the trend, the situation overall is the same in developed countries with universal health care.
There's something systematic about the development of modern economies where preferences towards childbearing are changing. Women want to be more committed to the labor force. That's not really consistent with having a large family. And those sorts of changes in attitudes I think, are a better explanation given the fact that it is, you know, so universal among developed countries.
These birth trends have long-term impacts. In the 1950s, the post-war baby boom in the United States and other countries affected politics, economies, and culture. Researchers say the current American baby bust will likely have the same far-reaching effect. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Greenwood Cemetery in New York is one of the oldest and largest American cemeteries. And now it has its own artist in residence. Anna Nelson tells us more in this report narrated by Anna Rice.
Since taking the artist-in-residence job at New York's Greenwood Cemetery, artist Heidi Lau's morning walks start at the grave of Tiffany's jewelry company founder, Charles Louis Tiffany.
At the door, you know, that's like, you know, I feel like it's kind of like, this is almost kind of like a miniature building, except not, you know, it's like taking all the elements of the building and then condense it, but it's not really a functional building. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like how like abstract and like almost like caricature.
There are 500,000 dead people here, among them many who were once famous, and as many gravestones. It can hardly be called a typical workplace, but it is one that is supposed to inspire the 33-year-old artist. It all began when the Greenwood, founded in 1838 and one of America's first rural cemeteries, announced that it was looking for an in-residence artist. Heidi Lau got the job.
For the residency and in general for all the art that we do here, we try to steer away from the Halloween-y and the spooky. And we had over 964 applications, and there were a large handful of them that were trying to, you know, do things with costumes that were spooky, that, you know, were ghostly, and that's not something we're interested in.
For 9 months, Lau was given a little house on the cemetery's grounds to do her work, as well as an honorarium of $7,500. Always interested in what happens after death, Lau, as a sculptor, has been trying to convey her perception of it through art. She came to the U.S. from China and brought with her the mortuary ceremonies she remembered when her grandparents passed away. She believes her ritual sculptures could be of use in New York's funeral homes. As for working alone at a cemetery, Lau says it has not been a problem.
The cemetery is very active right now, unfortunately, part because of COVID. You know, like it does feel like very like real or like sad, you know, that like, you know, seeing like grieving families and, you know, but like if you're talking about like, I guess like spirit stuff, I feel like I sense good energy. It's all I can say. And I feel like, this is like a place, where, a body get to like rest. Very spacious, you know, very nicely, you know, like I feel like the spirits here should be very happy. and they come visit me, they're welcome.
And while Lau is firing her sculptures in a special furnace, Greenwood is preparing to let her inside a special building that ordinary visitors never see.
So we are going to go to a place where very few people get to go, where Greenwood stores its archival collection. And so only people like Heidi and employees here at Greenwood will be able to access it. Yeah, so in here are all the paper material that relates to the cemetery's history. So going back to 1838. So every deed, every piece of paper relating to every plot or stone is kept here.
Why does Greenwood need an in-residence artist? It's a sort of an experiment for them, as they invite artists to seek inspiration among the cemetery's gravestones. Lau hopes the unusual experience will inspire her to create more.
I guess I don't think about being surrounded about death in that way, but kind of reminder that like there's no guarantee, you know, there really is no guarantee, you know, like yeah, death is never like too far away from anyone. I mean, especially now.
For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That's our program for today. Thanks for joining us on VOA Asia. Come back again at the same time tomorrow. In the meantime, you can follow us online. We're at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We also thank our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.